a forum in which the speaker was a principal on the plaintiff's side in a Supreme Court case. Our speaker was in Quill versus Vaco, and it dealt with the issue that he'll be talking about this morning. He's a graduate of Amherst and also of Rochester Medical School. He helped us when we were looking for speakers in the health field. And he's the director of a program on approach to the end of life. He's also the principal head of the palliative care program at Rochester. And he's the author of 5 books, one of them being entitled Midwifing Through the Dying Process. He's also written on the Diane case in the New England Journal of Medicine. So in every way, his credentials are substantial and far-reaching. And any of you have had any experience at all, say in a Midwest hospital, when somebody is awaiting death, know how complicated this situation is, how those who are fortunate enough to have had lifelong learning. My mother, when she died, had a physician who she had taught how to play the organ, and that was a bond of communication and trust. But that bond is frequently missing, and it requires systematic attention and study, just the kind of study that in a very humble and modest way Dr. Quill has mastered over the years. And so we're all very much looking forward to his discussion this morning.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with you this morning, and I'm honored to be invited to participate in this forum. There clearly needs to be more fora where these issues are discussed. We tend to avoid them, these kind of discussions, as a culture. So I applaud you all for coming, and hopefully we can learn together today. In medicine, we always talk with slides. It's a cultural thing, so I brought slides with me. I know that's probably unusual in this forum, but you'll have to bear with me. Let's see if I can get it to work. Whoops. Okay. My oldest patient was 108 years old, and she was mentally competent until really she died. For her last 20 years, she had a do not resuscitate order. And for her last 5 years, she had a do not hospitalize order. But she wanted treatments that were easy, that would keep her going. And she had great quality of life up until the end of her life. But even at the end of her life, at 108 years old, we finally had to make a decision whether to treat one more infection. So just because we have these capacities in medicine to keep people alive longer and longer, the hope was that we would keep people alive healthy a lot longer, that they would be alive, sick a little shorter, and they would die peacefully. Unfortunately, what has happened is we keep people alive healthy a little bit longer, we keep people alive sick a lot longer, and at the end of sick, we are faced with just really, really hard decisions about whether to use the next treatment or not. Now, so it's not a simple process at all that we that these successes have had in medicine. Generally quite positive. People are living into their late 70s and 80s on average. And yet, the end of this process is often not a simple event. To some degree, it's technology that has done this. We have choices now about ventilators, about all kinds of different treatments, so that the end of one's life has become, to some degree, a choice. And choices clearly have to be made. And to make matters even more complex, persons like your mother and my father lose capacity toward the very end. About half of people won't have capacity to make decisions for themselves at the end of life. So we're having to make decisions, we being family members and physicians, decisions on their behalf. And it's not all high technology. Some of the technology is very simple, things like feeding tubes. This is a picture of Christine Busilaki, a young woman who was in a persistent vegetative state for 4 years. Her family finally accepted the fact she was not going to get better. And then they asked the correct question, what would she want them to do if she could speak for herself? They felt quite strongly she would not want to be kept alive in this condition. And then they spent the next 4 years in the courts trying to have the feeding tube discontinued. Think of the Chavo case in Florida right now, if you think this can't happen right now. Just a small amount of family conflict around these issues, and it is almost impossible to stop such treatment. Those of you who have not done your advanced directives, the Chavo case should be a clear statement that you must put your values on the table very clearly, because otherwise doubt can come in. And of course, we have an end-of-life ritual to which we are all entitled unless we say explicitly that we do not want it. That's cardiopulmonary resuscitation, a strange way to honor people who are dying. It's a deification, in my view, of technology. Cardiopulmonary resuscitation does not work very well when people have multiple chronic diseases, when they are severely ill. It was designed for people who have sudden heart attack and are found in the field, and it is reasonably effective in those circumstances. Now, the news isn't all bad. We have developed wonderful programs to care for those who accept the fact that they are dying. This is Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, the mother of the hospice movement in some sense in the United States. And again, for those who accept that they are dying and who have a prognosis of 6 months or less, these programs are just outstanding ways to get care at the end of life that makes sense. A lot of the work in hospice may not be the kind of deep existential thinking about your dying that one might think. It's watching television together, it's playing cards together, but they are moments that families will never forget. Sometimes it's looking at the family album together. Really wonderful ways of spending the last time on this earth if you can accept the fact you are dying. Contrast that with spending your last days or weeks or months in an acute hospital. Sometimes it's a very challenging, moving part of care. It's not all simple, but our ability to be with people who are this sick is just a wonderful statement about who we are as a society. There is a technical part of hospice care as well. It's not all angels at the window kind of waiting for you to come. There are medications, there are interventions to try to keep symptoms down and keep comfort as good as it can be. But when it works and people are allowed to die peacefully, it is a wonderful process. It is, in my view, and this is where I probably differ from some physicians, a legitimate goal of medicine to help people die better. If we all have to die, then we might want to say that one of medicine's jobs is to help people die better with some dignity, with their personhood still intact. Now, one of the commitments we have in hospice, and I was a hospice medical director for probably 10 years, was that there were always, despite all of our efforts to keep people comfortable, there were always one or two cases where people still were dying in ways that were very harsh. Take for an example, a patient with severe lung cancer or end-stage emphysema. This person has decided not to go on a ventilator because going on a mechanical ventilator doesn't make sense. We still then have to make plans for how are we going to handle it when he gets or she gets very short of breath. So again, we have to begin to think radically about our ability to respond to some of the challenges that occur as part of the dying process when we don't use high technology. And furthermore, sometimes dying goes on a very long time and people get tired of it. It's wonderful, it's meaningful for a while, but if it goes on for a very long time, then people may start to talk to us about being ready to die now and not wanting to wait another week or month or months. And we have to learn how to have that conversation with them, in my opinion. So having had these views, this led to my, and I had helped many people to die indirectly, as all doctors do over my career. But then I met this patient, Diane, who had a rare form of leukemia. She had a 20% chance of responding to very aggressive treatment. And I thought for sure she would take very aggressive treatment. This was bone marrow transplantation and total body irradiation and so forth. But Diane actually did not want that treatment. She felt strongly that she would be in the 80% of people who don't respond, and that would mean that she would spend her last days and months in the hospital receiving aggressive treatment, and she simply didn't want it. And she was very clear about reminding me and everyone else who I had her see to try to talk her into treatment, that it was she, not us, who would be experiencing the effects of treatment. So then that raises the question, once we really tried to convince her to try treatment, she convinced us she really didn't want to, we think about what do we do then? And the answer is we do hospice care. So we offered her hospice care, and she was very appreciative of hospice care. She said, thank you for offering that. I would love to be on such a program. It sounds like it makes sense to me. But then she pushed the conversation a little bit further, and she said, you know, I want to live as long as my life has meaning, but when my life stops having meaning, particularly if it's associated with a lot of suffering, I would like to have a means for escape. And I'm going to worry about this until I get that settled, until I can know that there would be this means for an escape. And this was a challenging conversation to me. I had a lot of conversation with her and her family and with colleagues who had faced patients who wanted this kind of assistance before. And it finally led to my prescribing Diane some medication that she could take at some point in the future if her suffering became extreme. She agreed in exchange for that to meet with me before she would take this to make sure every stone had been turned. So then Diane went on a hospice program. This is a picture of her later on in hospice. And one of the things that's not very well understood about her case is that she took life-prolonging therapy several times during her stay on hospice, transfusions, antibiotics. She wanted to live as long as her life had meaning to her, but then she didn't want to live when her life stopped having meaning. And she finally did take this overdose when she was having overwhelming infections and when her pain was getting to a point that she had to take high doses of pain medicine that made her sedated. For Diane, like many patients in Oregon, being in control of one's mental facilities was what was really important to her. And that would have been the end of the story. These kinds of cases occur on rare occasions. She died quite peacefully with the assistance of the medication. Except that I got the bright idea of writing about this case in an article because I thought it was a case that really challenged people to think more deeply about the questions that we're faced with in caring for people at the end of life. In fact, prior to this time, the main person to articulate this question had been Jack Kevorkian, and Jack Kevorkian is so easy to dismiss. He's a pathologist. His methods are really kind of way out on the fringe. This was in the context of real medical care, in the context of hospice, much harder to have people dismiss easily, and I thought it would generate a good discussion, which it did. I also got some legal consultation, by the way, before I published this article, and I was told quite correctly that I would never be successfully prosecuted for publishing this. What I wasn't told was that you can go through a significant process on the way to not being successfully prosecuted. It was probably the difference between academic legal consultation and criminal legal consultation, which I subsequently got a criminal lawyer. Some strange things start to happen when you get involved in these kinds of things. The New York Times was writing very positive editorials about my article at the same time they were calling my university asking whether they were going to kick me off the faculty. And they were calling the local prosecutor's office, putting a lot of pressure on them to prosecute. So a lot of forces start to operate, in addition to the fringe forces in our society, or in my view, the fringe forces. The long and short of this was Diane had donated her body to science, and her body was eventually discovered. She had an unwanted autopsy, which did show she died in part from this overdose. This led to a grand jury, look at what I did, and the grand jury chose not to prosecute. And again, someone told me at the very beginning of this, this is where it would end up, that the prosecution would never want this to go to court, that they would allow the grand jury to make a decision not to prosecute, and that would mean that the prosecutors weren't deciding the case, the community was deciding it. Again, I had professional questions after this. There's a professional review board. That was a complete roll of the dice in New York State. It just happened that the three people on this review board happened to be people with experience in this issue in end-of-life care, and they also said that what I did was professional and so forth. So why did people get so worked up about this, and what happens when you start talking about this? This image I like because it really shows the people who are brought out of the woodwork to think about this and to have something to say about this, but the patient's voice and the patient's being is often out of the picture. And when you put the patient's voice in this, which I think I did through this narrative, it changes the dialogue. It all of a sudden starts to make people deal with a real person going through this with a real dilemma. And again, it is much harder to have this polarized discussion about this. So this led a few years later to our deciding to try to challenge the laws that prohibit this kind of activity. This was done in conjunction with Compassion in Dying, which is an organization that was started in Oregon and Washington. We basically made two arguments. One was a liberty argument that patients should have the right to be able to request this kind of assistance, and that doctors should have the right to be able to respond to these requests in the open, provided it's within their value structure to do so. In other words, they didn't have an obligation to respond, but they could respond. The other argument was an equal protection argument that we allow certain people to make life-ending decisions. People on ventilators can choose to go off their ventilator. People on dialysis can choose to stop dialysis. But another person suffering perhaps 10 or 100 times more who doesn't have a life-sustaining therapy to stop does not have a similar kind of choice. So this would be an equal protection argument. And I wasn't really optimistic that we would go too far with these cases, but in fact, we won both in the Ninth Circuit and the Second Circuit, and they won on differing grounds in the two circuits, and then the Supreme Court took the case. Experience presenting, I wasn't presenting, thank goodness, that is probably, has to be the most intimidating thing in the world to present before the justices. You get interrupted within, those of you who are probably legal scholars know, you get interrupted within about 30 seconds of starting your argument, and they ask very hard questions. But what was interesting about this from my point of view is that they really took the question seriously. There was no dismissing this as a radical question or a question that was out from left field. And so even though we lost the argument 9-0, some of the language that they use, I think, is telling about how they view that. And I'm going to just read a few quotes from each of the justices. O'Connor, this is an issue that every one of us faces. Ginsburg, this question raised the basic question about who decides. Souter, timing is a legitimate factor. Maybe we should wait until we know more. Stevens, I'm not aware of any doctor being convicted for committing this particular offense. Kennedy, this is a question of ethics, morals, resources, and our commitment to treat the elderly and the infirm. Breyer, what worries me most is that 1-2% need die in pain, but 25% do die in pain. Rehnquist, you're going to have factions fighting it out in every session of the legislature. How far can we go in regulating this? And Scalia, why is it limited to those on the threshold of death? We are all terminal. So the main elements of the decision was that they decided 9-0 there was no right to assisted suicide. We would say that we did not argue that there was a right to assisted suicide. We had raised a much more narrow question. They sidestepped the issue of exceptional cases. There was language in the decision about the potential right to a dignified death or a death that avoids pain and despair. There was language that suggested that avoiding pain and indignity in one's final days are at the heart of liberty. And clearly the justices encouraged debate and experimentation at the state level. They said there's no reason the states couldn't find the proper balance. Now, shortly after this decision, Oregon, which had passed the Death with Dignity Act about the time that this legal process was started, repassed the Death with Dignity Act a second time through a referendum. The first time it was 51-49 passage, the second time it was 60-40 passage. It wasn't that the issue got more popular, it was that Oregonians really resented the national political scene interfering with the will of the people. So they really voted it in that time. And then they appealed this case to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court chose not to hear it. So they really did say what they said that they weren't going to interfere, they didn't do. And I'm just going to present a little bit of data from Oregon, because Oregon is a remarkable experiment, if you will. First of all, will there be many cases, especially from society's most vulnerable groups? And again, if you take a look at the data now 5 years from Oregon, it's less than 0.1% of all deaths, all white, none lacked insurance, none motivated by financial concerns, most had cancer, and most had battled their diseases for a long time before making this decision. Would they choose assisted death if they had access to good palliative care? The majority of patients who chose this were on hospice programs, our Cadillac of end-of-life care programs. The much higher percentage of patients on hospice who chose this, it's a higher percentage than those who died who didn't choose this. And virtually all had some kind of health insurance. And again, this just shows the percentage of people in yellow who are on hospice, percentage of people who chose this option who were on hospice. So you can see it's really over 80% were on a hospice program at the time they chose to end their life. They all had insurance. There was one case in 1998 that did not have insurance, and that person had resources. Will requests for a physician-assisted death come from potentially controllable pain? Uncontrolled pain was very infrequently cited by the patients who chose this, and never cited as the sole factor. It was also cited much less in the control patients who did not make this choice. And this is consistent with multiple other studies. And you can take a look at the reasons people cited, things like losing autonomy, losing control over bodily functions, being a burden, decreasing ability to enjoy life, were the main reasons people chose this. So again, people who chose this tended to be very independent people who had a strong concern about their own personal autonomy and concerns about the loss of their bodily functions. So what can we conclude about that? The number who chose this in Oregon, where it's legally available, is small. It was not disproportionately chosen by poor people, people from minority groups, people who lacked education or insurance, or people who are fearful about the financial impact. Now, another argument people have made is what would happen to end-of-life care if this were legalized? And again, in Oregon, we have a case example where Oregon really leads the nation in many aspects of end-of-life care. It is the place to die if you have to die, which of course we all do, eventually. So they have a right to pain relief, a right to refuse treatment, advanced directive and surrogate decision-making laws, and a right to hospice, all as part of their legal structure. This has been a wake-up call to physicians there. Physicians now are attending pain management courses, learning how to do palliative care and end-of-life care in Oregon in a higher percentage than the rest of the country. Will it undermine palliative care? If you take a look at Oregon again, hospice referrals have increased overall since the passage of this act. Morphine prescriptions per capita have increased, and it's among the highest in the nation. Public awareness of end-of-life choices has increased. Palliative care consultants are now at the university, and again, physicians attend training classes. So what's happened since Oregon? There have been other referendums which have been unsuccessful. Michigan was very unsuccessful, had a very poor organization. There was a referendum in Maine that was a near miss. There have been state constitutional challenges in Florida, Montana, and Alaska that so far have been unsuccessful. There was a legislative opportunity in Hawaii because of a combination of things. The support by the then governor and the legislature was very closely divided on this, almost passed but didn't. Currently, there is a lot of activity in the legislature in Vermont and Maine. At the same time, the middle ground has moved forward dramatically. There has been tremendous process in delivering palliative care into hospitals, good pain management, and better choices within acute hospitals. And hospices are trying to expand their admission criteria so it's not just cancer patients, but it might be for patients who are dying of heart failure or dementia or other kinds of conditions. There is clearly much more acknowledgement nationally that there are going to be tough cases and that we have an obligation to try to face up to the tough cases. And other last resort practices have been deemed permissible, particularly terminal sedation, which is sedating people to unconsciousness if they have suffering that can't be otherwise relieved. The Supreme Court really said that they would support that kind of activity. And the option of stopping eating and drinking, which is another option that people now have that appears to be legal. So helping people die with dignity is one of our highest callings as physicians, and sometimes that means helping them face the fact that they are dying, and in rare occasions it means helping them find death, helping them find death when they are ready. Hospice and palliative care are the standards, and they can clearly be improved, but there clearly needs to be some choices for people who are receiving the best care and are still worried about how they're going to die. For some people who have witnessed a bad death, all they need is the reassurance that they could have an escape, which they will never need. They tend not to feel trapped then. They can go on and live very fully with the knowledge that they could escape. But for a rare patient, there still needs to be an escape in exceptional circumstances. Now, to try to bring this a little bit to life before I stop and invite your questions, I want to present one narrative for you so that you can get a sense of how this process works. This man's name is Jules. He worked at Kodak in Rochester in personnel. He was a lover of fine wine and food. He married a woman named Judith, who was part of our faculty at the university, and she was the administrator in our ALS, our Lou Gehrig's disease clinic. And they had had a lot of talks as they were courting. They met later in life about end of life issues and choices. Partly because of Judith's work in ALS, you can't kind of escape these kinds of issues. And they had made some commitments to each other about helping each other out if they got into a bad situation. They had one child Jules was working on a kind of a country home and building it himself. He was a big do-it-yourselfer, and he noticed that the hammer was flying out of his hand. He couldn't quite grip it very well. And this, he went to see a neurologist. They weren't sure what was going on. And then over about 6 months, a few more things happened as he lost function, he was diagnosed as having ALS himself. Now again, this was not something, ALS, those of you who know ALS, it's a disease where you lose, it's a neurological disease where you lose control over your bodily functions, but your mind stays fully intact. And you eventually lose the ability to move and then eat and potentially breathe. So it's a very serious disorder, and you don't know how quickly it's going to progress. It may be fast, it may be slow. At that time, to make matters more complex, Judith got pregnant for a second time, and Jules and Judith wanted somebody. Their doctors simply would not talk to them about the fact that he wanted some choice in dying. They said, you know, he's a young guy, he's got a young family, he shouldn't want that. He should want to live, and there are so many things we can do. So they wanted to just talk about the optimistic side and did not want to talk about the other side. He became a patient of one of my partners at that time, she was willing to have this conversation with him, although, again, it scared her to have it, because she didn't know what would be asked of her. as he delivered their second child, or they delivered the second child, he was one of these guys at the first child that was sort of biting the cord and tying the knot and all that stuff, very participatory. The second birth, he was in a gurney lying beside his wife, unable to physically participate, but still an active participant. And he had decided that he would want to live as long as he could, but when it got to the time where he needed a ventilator, a breathing machine, or a feeding tube, that's where he would draw the line. And Betty, his doctor, said that was okay. She might try to talk him into it when the time came, and he said that was okay. That was their arrangement. So as he got sicker and he lost the ability, he was losing the ability to breathe independently. He had a long and challenging hospitalization where he had a lot of shortness of breath. He was faced with potentially dying without a ventilator. After a long and challenging conversation, he finally decided that he would accept a ventilator. And again, this just raises this issue that sometimes as healthy people, we have trouble imagining that we could put up with what we'd have to put up with to live a little longer. So it gives one pause about healthcare proxies and living wills, but also it just says that as you get to those decisions, you have to really readdress them in depth. And so he accepted the ventilator. And just to give you a sense of why he accepted it, you could see that there were wonderful things that happened during this time for him. He was able, instead of working, to spend a lot of time with his kids and enjoy them in ways that perhaps he wouldn't have enjoyed them otherwise. But as his disease again progressed even more, he became harder and harder for him to eat. He lost a tremendous amount of weight. He loved to eat. He loved food. And again, had this same question now, does he accept a feeding tube? And again, after a long conversation, he accepted the feeding tube. This is, again, him with his children feeding them. As he accepted the feeding tube, he gained weight after that, but lost his will to keep going. He said that was over the top for him. He was now ready to call it quits, and he again now wanted to talk about this. Because even though he could now live with these life supports, he didn't really want to keep living under these circumstances. And again, as you can see, at this point, his children and he are going in opposite directions. His child's now able to feed himself, and he's not able really to assist in this process. So again, he now has the right to refuse treatment. He does not have to have these life-prolonging treatments. That's a legal right that he has. But it raises questions about what does one do if one takes somebody off a ventilator? Do you sedate somebody before you take them off? Do you have to wait for them to struggle before you provide sedation? And when you look at the literature, it's actually not very clear about this. Even though when you talk to experienced people who do this, it's quite clear that the right thing to do is to provide sedation in advance of somebody going off a ventilator. You simply can't let somebody die drowning who's dying anyway. So again, my partner, with some help from the rest of us and some searching in the literature, was able to make a commitment to allow him to come off the ventilator, to provide sedation before he went off. He set a date that was about 3 months down the road. It turns out it was April 15th. Tax day, because he wanted to be sure his affairs were all settled. And they set this date. He had a wonderful 3 months waiting for this date. At the time that he took his life and ended this, there was a small group meeting. Everybody had a support who was there, including the doctor, somebody to talk to. He played his favorite music, some music from the Amazon rainforest, which everybody else secretly hated. But he loved. They had some special wine and port for people to drink afterwards. And my partner, as he was getting ready to take the medicine before going off the ventilator, said, you know, you could turn back now. We can keep going. We could all drink the wine together and celebrate your life and, you know, choose to do this much later. And he said that he loved her too, but he was really ready this time. So they gave him the medicine, and he died peacefully as they took him off the respirator. And of course, everybody said after that, can we turn off this damn music? Because it was driving him crazy. But it was a beautiful death, and everybody who was there felt privileged to be there. Everybody was supported. It was a self-willed death in a certain way. It was a legally legal process. But it does tell one what is possible if people can talk openly with one another, think creatively, and not be afraid. So with that, I think I will stop and invite your questions. Thank you.
Who would like to begin the discussion?
Would you comment on the Florida case and the intervention of the governor and the legislature on that?
Yes. The Florida case, the Chavo case, I'm sure some of you have heard about and read about, a very tough case because, of course, this person who's on life supports, feeding tube mainly, doesn't have a voice now. And so the job of the people caring for her is to try to figure out what she would want under these circumstances. And of course, as you read all the hyperbole and even watch Nightline and the serious news programs, there is very little discussion about this person and her values and what she actually said, which is really where, from an ethical and moral point of view, you would want the discussion to be. There is a lot of discussion from the edges, but the law suggests that there is a hierarchy when someone hasn't named someone to make decisions for them, and that hierarchy names a spouse before parents. And in this case, the spouse, after 10 years, this person has been in a vegetative state, believed that she would not want this, and the parents believed that she would want life at all costs. And so what do you do? I will tell you, in New York State, this would not even have gotten to the courts because it would not have been, it would have been a case that you keep going with. Because when there is uncertainty about what to do, unless you have very clear evidence about what the person would actually want, then you must keep going in New York State. Other states are less rigid about this. The tragedy of this, there may be information about what this person really would want. Again, we don't have access to the records about what she actually said, which is really what you would like to have. But then you say, well, gee, why is Jeb Bush intervening? And what authority does he have to intervene based on no knowledge of the case? No knowledge of the case. And again, this was a court that really had looked at this issue very carefully. They had taken testimony from all interested parties and had believed that this husband, who was the legal authority here, should have the right to make this decision on her behalf. And again, I think it's tragic, and I think it's tragic partly because the most of the discussion has to do with, again, are we killing patients and issues like that, which really are not to the core of the point. The core of the point is what would this patient. The Quinlan court had it really right. If this patient could sit up for 15 minutes, understand her situation completely, what would she tell you to do? And they should be taking testimony about that and trying to figure out what that is, what they should do.
Who's paying for this continuing care?
Who's paying for the continuing care? We are all paying for this continuing
taxpayers.
Care. Taxpayers. Yeah. Yeah.
The next question.
Yeah. Good morning.
Could you wait for the mic, please?
I would like to for you to comment, because I feel very strongly, as you do, about this. How do the fringe elements, and I think we're being kind by calling them fringe, get involved in other people's business if all the family members are in agreement and want to grant the wish of the dying person? How do these people become involved? Is it if you're in a hospital? If it's not a religious hospital, why is it an issue?
The answer is that for questions that are legally settled, in other words, there's not controversy about the question that they don't hear about, they're not really involved. So we make, for example, when we take a competent person off a life support in the hospital, which we do, it's not a common thing, but we do on occasion. If we have, there's a lot of thought that goes into this. They are seen by a lot of people. They're seen by ethicists, by palliative care people, by psychiatrists to make sure that they're sure, but then they are really able to do such a such a thing. And in general, fringe elements won't get involved. As soon as you go to court, because it becomes a more public process, fringe elements will get involved. We had a case in Rochester of a man who was quadriplegic and had lived in the hospital for about 15 years and had made a decision after a long time that he wanted to stop treatment. And again, the hospital, the people in the hospital caring for him went through a very, very careful process over about 3 months, evaluating him, making sure he wasn't depressed, making sure he was sure. And as part of that process, the fringe elements got wind of this, and we had a real major problem on our hands. And this poor person had people trying to rescue him and so forth. So it's a very big problem, and it intimidates people from making certain kinds of decisions. It's very frightening to have the Cruzans, as an example, Cruzan's caring family, agonizing decision, you know, had these folks trying to rescue Nancy Cruzan from a hospital as she was stopping her feeding tube. And again, for them, it is an issue of precedent, not the person involved. And these folks feel very strongly about it, and they feel strongly that you can never know enough about a person's wishes to allow this to happen.
Bo?
Most of the examples that you alluded to seem to indicate that most of the situations were under controlled circumstances. Some of the fears that people have, it seems to me, are the uncontrolled circumstances, i.e. automobile accidents or a stroke in the home, where EMS is called and EMS comes out and begins to attach devices to the individual. Yeah. And there's the refrigerator case or whatever it is where you're supposed to put things on the refrigerator so people in the house will know how they're supposed to act. Well, that doesn't happen very often. So the patient goes off with all of these attachments and everything else. It seems to me it's much more difficult to get those removed once they're put in that way in an uncontrolled circumstance. Is that indeed the case, or am I reading this wrong?
No, first of all, from an intellectual, ethical perspective, there theoretically is no difference between not starting a life support and stopping it once started. There's an ethical consensus that those acts are the same ethically. Now, I think this is not a good line of argument, partly because they are similar ethically, but they are not the same. Anybody who has ever taken somebody off a ventilator knows that this is a very profound act and that people die shortly thereafter, whereas not putting somebody on a ventilator is a very different kind of an act. And commission, omission, all these kinds of issues. So they are certainly different psychologically and practically, even though they are both, I think, permissible. They're both should be permissible, but taking somebody off is harder. It is legally settled that those are both permissible, and ethically they are both permissible. But it is harder to do, and of course in some religious traditions, they are profoundly different. In Orthodox Judaism, stopping something that has been started is completely different than not starting it in the first place. Having said that, if you have been, let's say you were, now everybody knows the difference between do not resuscitate and advanced directives. In case you don't, I will tell you, a do not resuscitate statement or argument is to say that I don't want to be resuscitated right now. If I had a do not resuscitate, which I do not, if I have a cardiac arrest here, I want you to resuscitate me, because I do not have a do not resuscitate. You want you to resuscitate me. If I had multiple chronic diseases, I would definitely have, and was at a different phase in my life, I would have a do not resuscitate order on my refrigerator so that I wouldn't get resuscitated, because I wouldn't want to go through the resuscitation. That would be me. I think I would. Who knows what I'd be able to do. But that has to do with right now, the treatment right now. Okay, advanced directives has to do with what treatment you want if you lose the capacity to speak for yourself in the future. So I have an advanced directive. My advanced directive is clear that if I am not going to recover, I want only morphine for anything that's wrong with me. Shortness of breath, morphine, hangnail morphine, no fluids, no nothing, morphine. That's what I want. And so if I have this cardiac arrest, you resuscitate me, my heart recovers, but my brain does not. You then ask the question, what would he want if he could sit up and speak for himself? You would read my advanced directive, and you would say, boy, he wanted morphine and nothing else. And then you'd be obligated at that point to stop everything and give me, you know, what I had requested. So people can stop. If you do start, you don't have time in a resuscitation situation when there's uncertainty to look for the paperwork. In an uncertain situation, you want people to resuscitate. It's a hard procedure, but you want them to do it because a delay of 4 or 5 minutes is the difference between a brain that survives and a brain that doesn't survive. So you want people in conditions of uncertainty to resuscitate. And yet, if they resuscitate in error, you want them to stop as soon as they're sure there was an error. So if you've resuscitated a hospice patient because you didn't know they were a hospice patient, as soon as they get to the hospital, you would then meet with the family. You would say, we did this in error. We apologize. This seems like we did the wrong thing. Are we all in agreement with stopping? We stop. And we will do that right in the emergency room.
Cliff buys, and then the lady next to one row up, the ladies first, and then Cliff buys, and then the gentleman up in the back.
Ladies first.
Thank you. Can one have, in a general power of attorney, delegate the authority to someone to make the decision?
Yeah, that would be a healthcare proxy, and that can be done in the same document as a power of attorney, but it would be a separate section of it for healthcare matters. But yes, one can delegate that. Now, could you delegate it as a person with capacity? Could you delegate that? You probably could, but in general, people would still want to talk with you if you had capacity. But the delegation is generally if I lose capacity in the future, and that's what a healthcare proxy document really is. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
And then Dr. Cooper.
What has been your experience in dealing with people of strong religious faith as patients and as family and other concerned parties?
Well, as you know, we do palliative care consultations in our hospital, so we see the sickest of the sick who are often involved in this sort of very end of life, very advanced disease situations. And finding out about their religious tradition is one of the first places you must go. It really drives people's values. And so finding out what their tradition is, but also their views within that tradition. For example, you know, there's the people talk about the double morality of the Catholic Church. You know, a lot of people who are staunch Catholics will believe in physician-assisted dying for themselves as an individual. They're still strong Catholics. That's just how they feel about themselves as individuals. Whereas others, that would be the last thing that they could ever think about. So you really have to hear what their religion is, but also hear what their views are and how they see their religion applying to the particular circumstances they find themselves. And the variation is tremendous because we're a very religiously diverse country. And it's one of the more interesting and, I think, exciting parts of this work is trying to figure out how religion can impact and help people make decisions. We often bring people in from their tradition, you know, if it's an unusual tradition or they have a clergy that they've worked carefully with, we'll bring that clergy into our family meetings and try to help them help us make a decision.
Dr. Cooper.
Presumably increasing numbers of people will be coming to their physicians to ask advice as to what they would recommend for what procedure to be used in case they did want to end their life. So what are you recommending? What are students being taught to recommend to individuals? And where should individuals document this? And can this also be included in the medical proxy, in your will?
Just to illustrate the difference, think about the difference between what kind of conversation one and documentation one could have in Oregon versus Virginia versus New York. Okay, in Oregon, you could talk about all the options and you could document a person's wishes and views with regard to this, and it would be a very helpful piece of documentation. In the rest of the country, if someone said, you know, I would really like to have access to physician-assisted suicide, I want to have all the options on the board, you're not likely to document that, because if you start documenting it, that can create some legal vulnerability down the road. So again, the rest of the country, if physician-assisted suicide is put on the table, it's put off the document. So it becomes a secret process that there's no record of, and there's no second opinion on, and there's no, and that's a real problem in my view. It impedes open discussion. Now, what are the options that aren't physician-assisted suicide that people agree are possibilities? Because again, patients like Jules might come to you and say, "What are my options?" And you can say, quite clearly, If you're in severe pain, if someone's fear is I'm afraid of being in severe pain, I can tell them in any part of this country, I can give you as much pain medicine as you need, even if it sedates you as a side effect. And I have no hesitation about doing that if you're dying. You will not die from lack of pain medicine if that happens. If you're on a life support, you can stop it. And again, that's all life supports. Including medicines that might be life-supporting. And there's agreement across the country that those can be stopped. The two gray area possibilities that are legal, again, and this would, whether you could find somebody to talk to you about this depends on their knowledge about these options, are stopping eating and drinking, which literally anybody could theoretically do. It's open to anybody. And heavy sedation for suffering that cannot otherwise be relieved. So again, you could be sedated to unconsciousness to escape your suffering. And again, those are legal options generally supported by most hospice programs. Ethically, I think more complex, and I think under discussion in the country. How are people being taught about these options? They're being taught about the first two, pain medicine and stopping life supports. The last three, I would say it would be very variable how much you're taught about that as a medical student.
You mentioned the eating and drinking, because my mother, when she was dying, I thought she just couldn't, she wouldn't take any food. And I thought it was just medically that she just didn't feel like eating anymore. She was under hospice care, and then she just, she wouldn't even take any water, nothing. Yeah.
So there's a distinction to be made here. Sometimes people, as they are dying, lose the ability to eat and drink as a natural part of the dying process, and that's not what this is. That's just dying, and that's just restraining yourself from putting in an IV or a feeding tube. This is actually people who are physically capable of eating, who choose to stop eating and drinking because they are ready to die. And again, it requires a tremendous amount of discipline because they still have the ability to eat and drink, and particularly at first they do. Again, the first time I heard about this, I thought it was so radical that I thought it was didn't make any sense. But the more I have thought about it, and now I've cared for a few people who have tried this option, it is something that has a beginning, a middle, and an end. Families can come together for the process. It generally lasts 10 days to 2 weeks. There's a time to say goodbye. There's time to rethink whether it's the thing you really want to do. And for many people, it gives them that control that they need. So now that I know I could do that, I can then choose to keep going a lot longer than I thought I could. Did any of you see the Moyers series on dying? A few of you did. There was a ALS vet who did the assisted dying. He wanted somebody to talk to him about could he find some way to help him to die. And if that doctor said we can't, he was a Southerner. I can't remember where he was from, but he had a nice Southern accent, and he said, "Well, we just don't do that stuff down here, But he didn't say what they did do, and if he had been knowledgeable about the possibility that this man could have stopped eating and drinking, this man could have then worried about other things for the last year of his life. He would have been free to worry about it. He had to come to that conclusion himself. And that was after agonizing and thinking for a long time. So again, if we could learn to have this conversation and learn to get these things out in the open, that would be a tremendous plus.
Dr. Weary, and then Victor.
Can a durable power of attorney override a controversy, in the rest of the family? This is in the Florida case. If the husband had had, or maybe he did have, but if the husband had had a valid, durable power of attorney, would that provide him with the ability to simply say, there's controversy, but I have the power of attorney, and this is my will?
The answer is I don't know. In theory, that if someone's gone to the trouble to empower a person to represent them when they can't represent themselves, theoretically, that person should have the legal authority. Just like a patient could make that decision for him or herself, even if the family was not happy with it. Having said that, you would like to have that durable power of attorney be able to say, I'm making this decision because she said this. She said these things to me over and over again. I think armed with that, you could make that decision. If you were just named the durable power of attorney, but you didn't have information about the person's values, and other people were coming up with questions about what his or her values were, I think you could raise that in question and end up in court. But a named proxy, durable power of attorney, with information about the person's values that were consistent with the decision, I think that would be enough to protect you. Should
Victor Yonke?
Have you any known cases where the medical professionals, the doctors, have refused to withdraw life support?
Oh, I'm sure there are. For a competent patient, I must say I don't know the answer to that. For people without capacity, which is usually where these decisions come up, there are innumerable cases where people have refused because one of the challenges is that it's so easy to generate doubt about what a person would want. And so there are people who have refused to stop life supports. There have been cases where doctors wanted to stop life supports because they thought it was medically futile and the family thought it should be continued. The doctors tend to lose those cases. The Wangley case is probably the best known case in that regard. But I don't know of any, I can't give you any specific cases that have gone to court where it's been decided in a lasting way.
Dr. Edgerton.
We are facing a coming epidemic in Alzheimer's disease in this country. And some of these people are relatively young. A lot of them lose capacity to make such decisions as we are discussing today. What are your recommendations? Have you run into this in any instances of assisted suicide? Should doctors be instructed on making the diagnosis of Alzheimer's to get an advanced directive at the earliest possible time from these individuals? What are your thoughts about this problem?
It's a gigantic problem about to become even more gigantic. Probably 50% of people in their mid-80s will have some form of dementing illness. So, if we live long enough, a good percentage of us are going to have such a problem. So how can we best protect ourselves if we say, what I recommend to my patients who are afraid of this is to for sure do an advance directive. Because at least then their values get on the table and they will have made statements about it. Now, assisted suicide, if you lose capacity, is off the table because assisted suicide requires a competent patient's request. Okay? You want to be sure that the person is sure right now that they want it, and there's no way you can be sure of that because people change their minds. Now, you could make an argument people could be allowed to make this request by advance directive, but I think most people, and I would be one of them, say that's off the table. What's on the table? Comfort-oriented care, hospice care that puts the person's dignity at the highest level and makes every drop of treatment geared toward their dignity, quality of life, comfort, and no aggressive life prolonging invasive measures. At least that's the way most people want to be managed, and the way one can do that with an advanced directive pretty well. And I think naming a proxy who is somebody who is assertive, who can protect you, who understands your values, is also a key part.
Yes, but Dr. Mr. Williams.
Thank you. Thank you for a very nice presentation. I enjoyed it. In the medical profession, which I belong to, since the Oregon law came into effect, I wondered how much significant discussion within the medical profession about dying in general and assisted death there is.
There is, I would say, much more discussion about dying in general, hospice and palliative care. Probably there's been a tremendous amount of discussion about that among the medical profession. Tremendous movement forward with palliative care, which is hospice-like care for people who are still continuing some active treatment. So, you know, hospice requires that you forego all active treatment, which means that many people are never going to be able to take advantage of hospice. But the same kinds of treatments should be available to those who are continuing some active treatment. Again, this is where palliative care, I think, comes in. There's been a lot of movement in that area. Around the issue of choice, there's a tremendous amount of ambivalence about how much choice people should be allowed and whether this should be a matter of choice. And there are real fault lines that come within the medical profession, within organizations, within the public, within religions, around how much choice, should this be a matter of personal choice. My personal belief is that as the baby boomers age, the baby boomers who have had choices about everything in their lives, throughout their lives, the notion that they are going to let, you know, the AMA or other big institutions control how they die, I think, is not going to happen. So I think there's going to be some cultural movement in this regard. I do think these development of options that aren't assisted suicide, the stopping eating and drinking and heavy sedation, are very important. Because assisted suicide, even in Oregon, that's 0.1% of deaths. It's not a common event. And there's, you know, that's out of lots of deaths. So we need other mechanisms and ways of dealing with suffering. And I think we're developing them. And I think that's incredibly important. So we can now help people who are adamantly, morally, personally opposed to assisted suicide, who are dying badly. We can provide ways to help them die that are within their own value structure. And that's really, really wonderful.
Last question, Charlie Smith.
First, I'd like to commend you, Dr. Quill, on your presentation, and also to Peyton Weary, who I think has helped organize a large part of these recent series that we've had on medication. And the next question I want to ask, though, is to you about the Hemlock Society. I had an uncle who, for years, talked about belonging to the Hemlock Society, but when the time came, he opted out.
Right. Well, you know, I think it speaks to the importance of having a Betty Rollins. Do you all know Betty Rollins, the ABC News commentator? She helped her mother to die with assisted suicide and wrote a book about this. And her mother talked about the feeling that she had as she was really sick of being trapped in a room from which there was no escape, sort of a Sartre no exit kind of situation. And of course, Betty had resources and knew everybody in New York and was able to find some through the Hemlock Society, somebody who could provide her with the medication. Once she had the medication, which she put up on her shelf and saved, she felt like she had a key to that room and she could now live in the room so that she no longer felt trapped. And this is, I think, of all the people in the Hemlock Society, for them, it is very important to have the possibility of an escape that most of them will never need. Because if you get good care and things change, you actually don't need it at the very end. But the possibility of having it is very important to many people. So the knowledge there could be an escape is critical, even though relatively few will need it. And that's probably where your friend was.
Yeah. We're 2 minutes over our adjournment time. We mustn't go on beyond that time. Just a reminder that many of you have capacity, and the end of the year is approaching, and we hope you won't forget about the Miller Center in that regard. Thank you very much.